Perfect Podcast. Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, a celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Ha, I'm but perfect, and I'm a functional fuck-up. Let's learn from somebody else's mistakes. And today we are learning from Mitch Harper. Now, Mitch is a cultural programmer and a film producer, amongst many other things. He dabbles in many artistic endeavors. But on this podcast, we mostly talk about his work with the Durban Film Mart and they're going online for the pandemic. And we also chat about Deliver Me, which is a film that Mitch has produced. He's since the last time we chatted on this podcast, he stepped his game up a little bit, and he is now in the production racket as well. We also chat about his time working at Trademark Tattoo, and we also, as is tradition on this podcast, we speak a little bit about Skynet. That's coming at you in just a little bit, but of course I need to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by you, which means you can support it by going to patreon.com/almostperfect or just the website almostperfect.co.z. I will catch up with you at the end of the podcast, but with all that out the way, here it comes. It's the Almost Perfect Podcast with Mitch Harper. So how are you living, Mitch?
Best way would be to describe it would be surviving, but I'm living good.
Yeah, that's like your surviving and my surviving are very different, because your surviving seems to be of a higher standard.
When you like things and you hate yourself, you just got to try and maintain the standards. But actually, I don't know about that. Hey, I think we're all making do with the grand pressures and existential crises of the world in different ways. Some of it is just more in our faces due to lack in placement in life and privilege, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. But how have you been? We haven't spoken on the podcast for a very long time. We've spoken in person quite a bit, but yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely going to not digress as hard as we did in the last one.
Not drinking this time, so that's a bonus.
Yeah, that is always a bonus, and I think it was Nostalgia Street. Of course, I think it was done in your old flat, if I'm correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And which was always like a den of so many, many memories. It was a great place to unwind, and yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that flat was like a refuge for so many of my friends who still... Because I was someone who lived on their own younger than a lot of people. Mm. Like I was 20 when my mom moved to Joburg and I basically just stayed in the flat that we'd been renting. I just took that over. And yeah, I came back from Splashy Fen one year and my mom was gone and my friends basically moved in.
Yeah. It was a great place of like... It was weird because there were like the only... there was only one long-term person that shared it with you besides your partner, right?
Yeah, two. Roger and Frankie.
Yeah, and I remember the Frankie period, but they were all... What I do remember is that somebody always was passing through your house, whether it was like in a sort of after the hours place to like crash, or someone was going through some drama, or someone was just passing through town, or if it was desperate, like places for bands to crash. So it was always great memories.
Yeah, a lot of bands in the history of South African music have slept in my flat for better or worse.
Yeah. I mean, you've been asking me how I've been living. Anyway. Sleeping is finally coming back to full capacity. I think, like many people, it's been an interesting 2 years, you know? Yeah. I feel like we were talking about this the other day, but I definitely... Since we've last been on, I definitely peaked in 2019 in the eat, pray, love aspect of life, but also in the professional. I don't think my professional life had been any better. But 2020, I think was an out the window situation. And it was actually kind of came through 2020 really in an interesting way. For me, I felt like I did really well. But
I thought you killed it from the outside.
Yeah, from the outside, but internally it wasn't great. Look, I found myself in some situations. I fell in love. I fell out of love in 2021. I fell in love again in 2021. It's crazy how things can. And then I fell out of life looked great. And I think I did the stupid thing, kind of millennial, like things that we're all reckoning with. I just put my head down and really worked. And I was like, well, if I keep busy, because, you know, when you live as a freelancer, you're signing up for either you've got to be really thrifty with your money, and not thrifty and buy like secondhand clothing. I mean, thrifty, you've got to be like really like buckle down for some hard years and get, and
you got to know what the specials are.
Yeah. Or like you can choose to like live a normal life, a normal, like fun life that most people, that like is normal by this world's measure of materialism and stuff. And you can be broke every month. So to find that middle ground was really difficult. And I kind of said, well, everybody else is going to be puzzling. So I think the thing to do is turn it up even more professionally. And I worked really hard, brought the first African online festival, well, film market.
The Durban Film Mart.
Yeah. And did that in 2020 because that was amazing. And then worked on a couple of other things. I made a film in 2020.
Was that in 2020? I thought that was 2021. I guess it takes a while for that stuff to get finished and come out and everything. And that's something I wanted to talk about the production aspect, because that's not something you were doing, but it's something you were interested in, you know, the last time we spoke. And how did you actually get involved with it? What project is it? And why did you get involved with this project?
So there's a couple projects
the one Deliver Me is what I'm talking
about. Yeah, Deliver Me. So that actually happened from a conversation that I had with somebody a couple of years ago, my business partner currently, Tani Mungwe. She was always into producing and had made films. She was a director at Uzalo at the time. And we had talked about getting into like me making films, because I work for the Durban Film Art now, and I work for a couple of other festivals and markets. And I have an organization called Engage that I started with Tani and also Temba Bebe from the Berlinale. And what it was is that I had always had an interest in film, but I came from like a film programming background. Now I'm doing a lot more stuff that's industry based. So we had always talked about films, and we had always talked about what we thought were good. We shared some very similar sensibilities, but like the two of us, we all had like very big opinions, and I thought our opinions were valid. And she had always talked about, you know, would you ever consider making a film? I was like, you know, I have some interest in possibly writing projects way down the line, because I have a weird relationship with writing. But then she introduced me to Yanu, the director, and we had actually decided to make, we had kind of like had like a courtship of like talking to each other about like what we're into and stuff. And he's a really amazing filmmaker with an amazing partner called Puleng. And they do amazing work in like theater, like very like lowbrow stuff. And he actually pitched me this idea of a sci-fi film.
Okay.
Which we're still making. It was called Persona, and it's very like Afrofuturistic, dealing with like interrogating a lot of like social issues that we are dealing with, and also discussions that we're having right now. And we had taken this film through, we had done all the work that goes into making like a press package and like a store and like treatments and everything that you do in pre-development. We applied for funding for films, for film funding, and it just didn't happen. And then when the lockdown happened, he and I were obviously checking in on each other. And he was like, listen, bro, I'm desperate to make a film. I found a crew. Let me tell you what the idea of the film is. And he like most great things that Yanu does, storytelling, it deviates a lot. So I had to be like, okay, cool. Let's bring it back. What are we making a film about? And it was like, well, it's a poetic meditation on migration. And then I was like, cool, down. How much do you think it will cost to make this film? He was like,
that's one way of putting that. I would have just said a documentary on Uber Eats drivers, but
I think it's more than just that log line, but it's definitely like in the Yanu way, it's definitely not the way that he would say it. It took a couple of tries before we could get to that essence of that's what it was. But like all things amazing with him. He had found a crew who were like really collaborative. Elijah Ndumbe, who was the DOP, Denise Onden, who did the sound technician, and we met some people afterwards who did some other stuff. But that was essentially the size of the crew. And he had done even better work in like going down during the lockdown, when we were allowed to walk around and do some research and talk to all the foreign nationals of who were Uber Eats drivers in Claremont and another suburb which escapes my mind right now. But got to know them, and then found Paul Mwase, who was this really amazingly open and amazing person, who I've only had the honor of speaking to him maybe twice, But he's an amazing guy, and he was really open and collaborative and like allowing us into his life and not only sharing his story. So we wanted to do the best with that. And these were all people that we found that were in the crew who had the same idea. And essentially we priced that, and he was like, we could do this for like 20,000 Rand. And I was like, cool, I'm sitting on some money. Like, I'd rather spend the money on this than on Amazon. And I always wanted to make a film, always wanted to say, it's part of my philosophy is I don't want to ever die saying I never tried something. Yeah.
So it was like a convergence of you had saved money, you wanted to get involved in film in some way. Production was something that you could help with, both in terms of money and then also in terms of other resources, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And producing the whole project, you know, putting all the admin together, making sure that we were all
ready. Well, because that's the thing. Like, let's talk about what production is, because I don't think I've chatted to film producers on here. And, you know, there's multiple aspects to what, when someone gets a name on a film, producer can mean a lot of different things, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then there's just your associate, executive.
Exactly.
So the way that we collaborated was very different to how we usually do. And production, what you asked, like, what is production? Production is hell. I haven't been on like a lot of big sets. I know how they work from, because I hadn't obviously worked, been in the film industry for maybe about 5 years at this point. No? Yeah. 6 years, six or seven years. So I had I'd always been in the film industry from the curation and programming side of things. So working festivals, but also markets. So working as like a project manager type character, but also like as an actual curator, like choosing films, but also like, and I'd been a reader for other projects and stuff like that. So yeah, so I always wanted to actually like make a film. I had some grandiose ideas back in the day of making a film, and now I could actually do it. It was tangible. So a producer is normally the person who works with every aspect of things to tie together. So that could be talking to the heads of departments for DOPs. So director of photography, talking to the head of sound. He's talking to the art department. They could be talking to rather everybody in catering. They're the ones who tie everything together. They're normally assisted by a production manager. And then there's a production assistant. And then there's runners. And then there's everything, grips. It's really big. And we actually had like a very small man crew. I think this is the thing about documentaries. You can do that. And documentaries, because you have long form storytelling, it's supposed to be kind of cheaper to make, but it actually isn't in the long run.
Why not? Because there's so much footage to go through.
Footage to go through, sets, because the story can't be told in like, you're not telling a story in 10 weeks. You know, you can follow someone for 10 weeks, but to add context to that, you have to put hours of research, hours of communication, hours of post-production. You might need to reshoot stuff. You might need to do follow-up stories. Things in people's lives change if you're following one specific character. So it's can be quite a schlep. Okay. It's quite a labor. I actually want to work on a fiction set so I can be like it's an in and out situation.
Yeah, because I was just gonna say like fiction and, you know, just movies as we know them, short films, like
cinema if you want to wear a monocle.
Yeah, like your non-documentary based films require sets, they require actors, they require all of that, but you can shoot it in a short time frame, get it all, like get everyone done, and then it's just the edit.
Yeah, I mean, fuck, you can make a film in 48 hours. Like the 48 hours film challenge is the proof in that, you know. Yeah. You can make a fiction, you can't shoot a documentary in 48 hours. You could shoot something a little like elaborate or like a fictionalized documentary storytelling thing, but you can never really add depth and context and honesty to and respect to your subject or your participants or your whatever the correct term is to your main character. That would be the one. Honesty in 48 hours. And a documentary, it's like to really be able to come up with the best story besides doing the thing of cultivating relationship and coming from it with a progressive and honest mindset that you're going to do this objectively. You're going to do this with the most care and respect for the people who you're following, who they're allowing you into their life and people allowing you into their spaces. You still have to shoot a lot of footage to be able to tell a whole story. So yeah. it's a lot. It's a schlep.
What's a producer's role when working with a director?
You guys kind of carry the film. So the director's the vision. They say the director's the vision and the well, the producers, the person that carries it through, the one that could be the brain and the heart conversation, you know?
Yeah.
So essentially you guys kind of, so the director may have a vision of the film. Most films come through a producer, though. They find a story that they find interesting.
And they find a director.
Yeah, they work with the director, or a director may work with them. Like another film that I'm working on, Woman Working, this was that film was started by the director and the producer together. They had a shared feeling towards a situation that was happening with the sex workers of Glenwood and Ambilo area, who were being harassed by the community policing forum. And and that was their story, and they carried it through, and we've had like a change of personnel. I was brought in to help carry that film over the line and get it through, and it's been really honored to work on that film as well.
How's it coming along?
We're in post-production right now, so hopefully, inshallah, we have a deadline for March. To
pitch a lot. The festivals? Or?
Yeah, and to some funders as well. That's the real honesty. Yeah, and that's the deadline. And I think it's been a project that they've been working on for like 7 years. So, you know, there's enough footage there to like get it over. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that because I know of the project, and it's something that, just talking, I mean, Tiny's been on this podcast before and speaking about that. And yeah, it is obviously an important topic in South Africa and in Durban and in Glenwood, which we're at.
And the world. Sex work is real work, yo.
Obviously, you can go listen to all episodes of this podcast if you want to hear about some sex work. But as to mostly straight dudes, we can talk about some other shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, tattooing. You've been working in as management at Trademark Tattoo. How's that been?
That was pretty cool. I was assisting the manager to take over because he was leaving. He had been an institution, a man called Tarzan. Been a notorious figure in Durban.
Tarzan.
Yeah. If you've never seen him, the best way to describe it is he's covered in tattoos, but like he's black and that's tribal. He has one tattoo, essentially. But he's like going on to do different things. He's been there for like 9 years. So I'd always been getting tattooed at that shop.
Been that long.
Yeah, yeah. He's been in Durban for like 10 years, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, only one of my tattoos is not by a Trademark tattoo artist.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a couple, but most of my tattoos were done there. And they've always been really cool people. And it was like I've had some downtime and thought that's what I wanted to do. Like I wanted to transition because I'm always dealing with the moral quandary of what am I doing with my life? And like I picked up art during the pandemic. And I was like, well, maybe I'm going to start painting for the rest of my life. And this will be a cool way to just earn some money and be in a space and creative. It was really cool. You get to see lots of Durban. You get to meet lots of people. Really cool shop to work in. Like nicest people, Nick. Really great. Kelvin, really great.
Rebecca. Yeah, I want to get Nick on here. I know he's got lots of stories, especially old hip-hop days.
Dude, old hip-hop, old graffiti. He used to run that I forget, but always forget what his store was called, but he used to sell hip-hop vinyls. And
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it was like, I think it may have even been on Florida back in the day. But yeah, I knew him. I met him at when he was still working at Electric Eye. I only realized he was only like 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 years into tattooing at that point, which was wild because he had tattooed me not long after that. But yeah, it was a really cool experience. I'm like, it's because of changes in life that I'm no longer there, but it's an amazing space. It was really cool. You get to like, made me better as like an artist as well. Like I'm self-taught and I I'm very loose and I wouldn't even call myself an artist because I don't think I am an artist in any way, but like as a dabbler of painting, a lot of just technical skill. Improvement because you're hanging around with people who know what they're talking about. They may not paint in the same medium as you, but like
I mean, but they also do draw and paint. Like that's like a big part of being a tattoo artist is actually like practicing your fucking lines like 100 times on paper. Like,
well, that's changed now because you know, like most things, technology has stepped in and like people have iPads and you can draw.
Or sure, line. You can make it doesn't it have to be on paper, but like yeah, you still have to practice drawing the line a lot.
I think it's like any craft. That you got to keep practicing. I think any good thing, like anything that's really difficult in life that you do with your hands, if you don't do it forever, if you don't keep at it, it dissipates. There's an actual term for it. I think it's like a diminishing skill.
Okay.
I can't remember, but yeah, if you don't practice that shit, you'll never catch up. But like, I mean, that technology has made it easier for everything. I mean, it's the way that we managed to pull off a market in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty early on. So we worked, well, you brought me in to work a bit on the DFM as a panel host kind of guy.
But a moderator,
that's what that's called. Yeah, no, so I'd done it before, like in person, and this was, like I'm not going to lie, especially this year, doing it from home and not even like doing it at the venue, like was amazing. I was just like, I wish I could do this always, but I know like as a festival administrator, might have felt a little bit different.
It was frightening for that time because no one knew how to do it. Like we had all guesstimated.
Sure.
And I think we really, because all the major festivals who had decided to go online, because the last big festival was the Berlinale / European Film Market in 2019. And that was the last big in-person festival. The rest, no one else, like Cannes and everybody else, had made the decision to do it in the lead up to us and then kind of around the same time as us. So nobody really knew what the model was and we did it. And it was frightening. But now it's like, it's interesting because there's a lot of Zoom fatigue in the world. And sure. I think it's shared across. I think as we've all lived our experience online, it's been different for the last couple of years. So you are finding people who find it more difficult. Part of me likes it because like I am, as an extrovert who hates being around people, just very Larry David-y, it is kind of nice to be secluded, but it's also not good for one's psyche. We are social animals. Like we need to be around people.
Yeah, I kind of feel you there. Although a part of me has really enjoyed like the isolation in different ways. You know, sometimes I've hated it, but sometimes I've quite enjoyed it. And I've actually found like the Zoom stuff to be quite helpful in alleviating that almost. But at the same time, I do miss just having drinks with someone at the hotel bar, you know, like just random people who you met on the panel earlier and like you find out all these cool, interesting stories that, you know, like you never would have known. And like, then you've got like a friend like in Canada, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're just at that generation where we are going to miss that, because I think the metaverse generation are going to find it. They're going to find it a lot more comfortable than what we do.
Sure.
And I do share that experience, what you're saying.
I'm just not going to fuck with that. Like, no. What do you fucking mean? Facebook, VR, fucking no. Like, there's a lot. Like, I don't even need to like say more than that. Yeah. Facebook,
VR,
and VR. Like, can you imagine a worse combo? Like, you're going to get served ads whilst fucking, I don't know, like, busy, like, looking through photo albums. I don't even fucking know what people are going to do on there. I know that my VR experiences I've already had have been too, like, this is going to suck me in.
It suck you in, like, this is too real. Like, this is, like, I've definitely blue-pilled it right now.
Yeah, like it is. It's like I've watched The Matrix. Like I don't want to live in it. Like I don't want to actively choose that life. Like I want to touch fucking grass, you know? Like
yeah, man. I think though, like we're heading towards that direction. Like to speculate, the more and more like the cynical me sits here. The more older I get, and the more practical I kind of get, I feel like we're going to head towards that thing. I don't like it. I don't like it one bit, but I think it's going to be that way. What I wonder is like, what stage do you remember? Demolition Man. How they have intercourse is that they do it via VR headset and they don't touch. And I'm like, I don't think we're that far away. Like, I think we're maybe 15 years away from that.
Yeah, although Black Mirror brought up a very interesting... Did you see that episode with Anthony Mackie?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It's really... Like, Black Mirror is kind of weird in terms of that it's like it's as predictive or it's as accurate in its depiction as The Simpsons is many things. Down the line. But it's like addressing the uncomfortable truth of what's approaching us at a rapid pace.
I agree with you there. And that's what I guess the whole thing is for me.
It's amazing.
It's just like, it's also like reading Baudrillard and fucking, you know, Marshall McLuhan and those kind of guys. Like,
look at you.
And, you know, doing mushrooms and smoking weed and all of those things make me worry a little bit about, like, because that's the thing. Like, I already, like, you know, through like hallucinogens, like dabble with an unreality or some people might think a more real reality. I just feel like if someone else can control it, that's a fucking problem for me. The metaverse would be able to harvest so much data from you. And that's the fear. Like, I think the technology is impressive. It just, what we've seen with the history of fucking tech in the last 20 years is that it's very manipulative and very data, you know, it just wants to steal all your fucking data and keep you on the platform. So I just imagine it being an incredibly addictive thing that you that finds ways to just keep you there and buying shit. And you're not even buying real things.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with you.
Sure. You just they see it coming.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah,
I think
that's the problem.
Look, and I think, look, we're also like, I feel you about the like the unease and the uncomfortableness of like having your data reaped, but we're so far down the line already. Like everything to know about you is already there.
Sure, but you can stop. You can
unless you're like Silk Roading by like the age of 14, there's like your information is fucked. You went to MIT. Like,
of course, but the thing is, you can like then just not use Facebook, not use Google, not use the things that have your data and are then utilizing the data to manipulate you.
Yeah, man. But
you
I mean,
you can also change phone numbers, get new email addresses. Like, you can do things. You can be doing it.
You can do that, but like, so this is an interesting thing, right? Because this comes down to like most great theories. Great, everything is great on paper until it reaches the hands of like human beings, and so it's not that the technology is doing it. The technology isn't holistically sentient that is at that point. As long as I have to press control alt delete on a computer, don't tell me that the computers are making the decisions for me. They're making the decisions as through an algorithm that you've programmed.
Well, yeah, that's
the humans
problem.
That are things. So as long as we continue to exploit each other, then we will like that's going to happen. At what point though do the robots like either go, yo, these humans are fucked, I gotta get rid of all, we're gonna wipe the only safe, like the only way that this planet survives is that they wipes us all out or enslaves us, like that episode of Rick and Morty when they get the dog sentience. Or when does it like get to a point where like they now adapt their technology? We go full Matrix, you know, they read our algorithms and now they punch it in.
Well, you see, like a part of me used to like be really, I mean, I'm still interested in these ideas, but like a part of me used to think like, oh yeah, the machines can become sentient. And now I just don't think it's possible. Like now I just think like, because the way I understand AI and stuff like that, it's always just a computer program.
Yeah. Well,
like, it can never not just be a computer program. It's never going to have feelings. It's like it can respond in a way that's emotional, but it's not the same thing as feeling a feeling.
Yeah. And a big disclaimer, this is two bozos right now who are like speculating on like secondhand information that we've read and heard from other people who.
Yeah,
who
this is just stuff that I heard on the Joe Rogan podcast.
You know? Oh, Jesus. Yeah, look, from what I do know, and mine's not as much Rogan influence, though. Old Rogan. Of course, no. We just gotta clarify. You're white, dog. You're white and male. They may just be like he actually listens to the Joe Rogan podcast.
I mean, it's just because he's no longer on YouTube. That's why I no longer watch.
Yeah. If it's free, it's for me. Okay. I think can you even get Spotify? Can you get the Rogan on the free Spotify? I don't think.
Yeah, you can.
They must. Yeah, because I guess he's like the fact that they paid that dude $100 million for how many years is his contract? It's not $100 million.
I don't know if you know this though, but like it's getting dangerous out there. You can't say anything, bro.
Yeah.
Like you gotta watch what you say.
Cancel me, bebe, when it comes to this. Yeah, but no, I mean we always gotta watch our P's and Q's, but like can't believe they gave him $100 million. Like that's ridiculous money. Like at what point do we go like when you look at football and how much money's been flying around in football and like $300 million gets thrown around like nothing.
To me, creators getting, you know, value for their work is probably a good thing, but also all that money being centered around like a handful of already famous people and their podcasts, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily seem to be investing in infrastructure or, you know, the future of the medium.
100%. You're like, I wonder if, yeah, I mean, not even like, even at a grander scale, like that 100 million, if all the companies that could afford to give somebody 100 million, and there's hundreds of them right now.
You could literally, if you gave 10K to like every podcaster, because you could do it. Yeah. Like with 100 million, you could give 10 grand to like every podcaster that exists in the world, probably. Haven't done the maths, but 100 million is a lot of fucking money.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you put it in the dollars, you know, that's expensive.
Exactly. That's not the point. It's to keep him there because he's exclusive. And yeah, I just hate the way the fucking world works these days.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, look.
And it's only getting worse.
Like one thing that I found hilarious, but also proved my theory is that the state needs to look after its people. We found that out during COVID, and it was pretty wild that like a lot of like far right, like anti-Bernie policy people who were like, "Fuck him and his wealth and his love for welfare state." And as soon as they were out of work, they were like, "The government needs to look after us." And it's like this is what he's been wanting to do with taxes and this is what we're supposed to do. But like, how does big business continue to get away with taxes? Like, if you think about it, the fact that they have the audacity to give one person 100 million. I know how capitalism works, people, by the way. I've read John Adams, and I understand how this shit works, right? But how on earth, like, if you give 100 million, should you ever turn your nose up at paying a tax? Like, it's ridiculous. And especially, isn't Spotify based in Sweden? I'm speculating. I'm pretty sure.
It's one of those countries.
But yeah. So you'd think, like...
Wait, did he not pay tax for that?
No, there's, like, there's, you know... If they're spending that much money, and then like, how much money are they generating really? Because if you ask the artists are not getting paid with Spotify. Like,
no, they're not making the thing. That's also the funniest thing, is just like, Joe Rogan gets 100 million, but everyone else is getting 5 rand.
Yeah, well, but isn't it something ridiculous, like it's 0.00110 of like a dollar or some shit?
Yeah, it's a pittance.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, like, although for me, like, this goes out on Spotify because some people are going to be listening to this on Spotify.
Yeah, I love Spotify, by the way. I actually really do. I just, like, spent all night, like, harvesting stuff to listen for the next, like, 2 months on Spotify.
Yeah, you see, I've got leaks.
Yeah.
same thing.
Yeah.
Both times, the artist isn't getting paid.
So yeah. Man. Well, yeah.
Yeah, shit. This got derailed. I like that. That's the way it goes.
Like, getting back to 20, like, coming through the pandemic. So 2020 was amazing for me in terms of, like, work, but I also, like, didn't go through it smartly and burnt through, like burnt out pretty hard. But I also recognized that I had some past trauma that I needed to work through. I'd always had, like, a thing. One of the best things that I did was start therapy in 2020, and that survived. Okay. But 2021, not such a great year. Like, for me personally, like, a lot of ups and downs. I still managed to, like, do really well in work. But I also realized that I needed to prioritize other things in my life. The way we deal with stuff in this modern age is, like, it's quite crazy and quite heavy.
What do you mean?
Well, it's like, you know, the more that we seem to grasp with, like, the concepts of mental health, the more that we seem to be, and also, like, a healthy, like, work and life balance, the way that we've now come to realize that for the longest time, we've really had really terrible ways of dealing with our traumas that we go through. And when I say traumas, I don't mean just like the big shit that happens in your life that is significant. I also mean like the day-to-day, like, fuckery that people go through.
Sure.
And, you know, unhealthy ways of dealing with it, like, not talking about it, but also just working yourself to the bone. And I think what I realized in 2021 is that I'd never seen so many people talk about, creatives especially, talk about burnout. And I don't know how you feel as a content producer, but do you feel like I worry about where we're going to be as a society, especially for the creatives, us as a society in general, if we continue to burn out at the race that we're doing, because the creative industry can't be the only place that's experiencing this. I think a lot of people got rocked and were forced to deal with how they were viewing the world in 2020. But I feel like the rest of the world is also like, I don't think everyone's completely engaged with the trauma of what's happened with it.
Sure. But I also think as creative people, like, things are a bit more precarious. Like, our skill sets, it's something I've noticed. Like, I thought I had a lot of skills. And, like, I do. But when magazines are closing and fucking websites are shutting down and fucking PR companies are shutting down and, like, content is now being created by fucking, you know, literally by AI... It's like your role then in that space becomes more limited, you know, in the more commercial space becomes more limited. And then in the creative space, it's hard to create because everything is now dependent on what you create to make the money. Like, it's that work-life balance is such a tough thing when you're a creative because, you know, your art realistically isn't going to be your income. Like, depending on who you are and how far you get. And then to get there, you've got to play all these games. You've got to do the social media stuff. You've got to do the PR. You've got to, like, focus on so many things that it's almost impossible not to get burnt out by just the levels, the difficulty of making it. And I say making it literally just as someone who can pay their bills off of creating art, like, I think is... getting harder and harder each day, you know, even though we've got access via the internet, even though we've got an easier way to an audience, the audience is also trapped, you know, in getting likes and this and that, and, you know, appealing in certain ways. And you as an artist have to appeal in all these different ways, and you have to have fucking YouTube strategy and a Snapchat strategy and a fucking all these things just to create art. Like, it's no longer just about, like, that's the thing. So beyond the pandemic, it's like just being an artist, being a creative is no longer, you know, just this one thing. It's now this thing where you have to know, like, how to do a million different things. You have to know how to engineer and fucking produce and sing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's many, I agree and disagree with a lot of what you're saying.
Okay.
But like very few places where I disagree. I think what it is that there's a lot to unpack on a lot of different levels there.
Sure.
I feel like because we as a society, the many things that have led to where we are today in terms of where we are and how much we consume. So let's go back to the point number one, like media. Media is at such a precarious position right now. As someone who came from a media background.
You were a journalist. You started as a journalist.
Yeah. And my dad is a pretty notorious journalist.
Notorious is a good way to put it.
Yeah, he's famous. He's like a really, really respected journalist. Famous is the wrong word. He's respected. And he and I often engage with this. Like, there's never been a worse time to be in the media industry because, number one, people don't consume media like they used to. Like,
no.
From the very there's so much information in the world that people have learned, have not learned the ability to, critical thinking is part of it, but it's also just being able to recognize what is disinformation and what is information and what is, like, because also we've become so casual with trolling and memes.
With it though, like on Twitter, like, you know, I'll still get caught out, but like,
yeah, nobody's perfect. I mean, every day we find shit. Like, like I didn't believe Betty White was dead for like a good hour.
Fuck yeah, Marty and I were pretty like, because we were like, last year we were chatting about it, you know, like when Betty White turns 100, like it's just gonna be like the best day ever.
She fucking jinxed herself by going on Twitter and talking about that cover. She should have never spoken about that cover.
I don't know what
it was. Like, she was gonna be on like one of the big magazines at like 100 years old celebration, and she like went and tweeted it, and
oh wow,
she tweeted it and it fucking got out.
The universe was like, nope,
she jinxed us, bro. She jinxed us.
Yeah, I felt like it was just 2021's like final act of cruelty.
Can we talk about like not only older generation, but even like people who were like slightly older than us, like how many critically like good contributors to work and life passed away, like, and at a rapid rate, yo.
I mean, this year hasn't stopped fucking Bob Saget died. That guy was my first fucking TV dad.
Yeah.
Like,
I was thinking
literally
about that.
He was like my dad. And then I heard him swearing on Entourage and having strippers. And I was just like, he's even better than I thought.
Yeah. His stand up is actually like super
dirty
underrated
as fuck. Like, yeah. It's, yeah. He's quick. He's always turning things into jokes. Like,
yeah, man. It's pretty crazy how many people and significant people that we lost. Like, I like,
but it's also not just that there's more significant people now. There's more art that's being produced. There's more people who are significant in different circles. And
but
so,
also significance in terms of like how long does things last in the cycle is a totally different thing now.
Sure.
You know? I was watching something where somebody was like, they were debating about like what the best thing of the year was. I think we were talking about like a verse, and someone was like, yo, someone brought up a verse that released two or three weeks ago. And the guy was like, are you kidding me? That wasn't that 2020. He was like, no, bro, that was 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he like was genuinely shocked because he was like, fuck, there's so much to consume now that like you forget that shit, like what was critical and how long ago you listened to it.
Yeah. And it's also like, how can you say what the best verse of any year is anymore when there's literally just, you're never going to hear them all.
You'll never hear them all. So
you'll never hear all the good ones.
Yeah.
You'll never even hear all the great ones.
As long as Andre 3000 keeps coming out like to do two verses a year, you're gonna hear some great ones. You're gonna hear some mind-blowing shit. Like, he had my verse of the year last year, and it was on an album that I gave no fucks about. Well, it was put on the deluxes, the Life of the Party by Kanye West, where he's like rapping to Kanye's mom, and he's like asking him to speak to his dead parents and like talking about how much he misses them. Every time I listen to it, because it's on an old Kanye beat. It's like a soul sample, and like I cry every time it plays. Not cry, like ball, but I definitely well up, and I'm like, shit, we've lost some people. Like, it's been a crazy 2 years for the globe.
Yeah,
we as South Africans especially, it's been insane.
Yeah, I mean, every country's been dealing with it in its own ways. Like, that's also the thing. It's like, I just look in America. I mean, I get annoyed by the entitlement in a way, because they're always like, give us stuff. And we're like, if we had to tell our government to give us stuff, like they can't even give the 350, you know? So it's like, it's just weird seeing their complaints about like, we need these extra safe masks. And like someone in the government was just like, half the country's not going to fucking wear them. And everyone's like, and it's like, but he's right.
Yeah, but also
don't boo me, I'm right.
But I mean, entitlement goes, as you know, even we're South Africans, we are fucking entitled.
Oh, like, compared to the rest of South Africa, or the rest of Africa and the rest of like the world. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I can never remember what the context of it was, but there was some dude, there was like some debate that was happening across the continent on Twitter, and someone wildly, like, unruly tweeted that South Africa is the England of Africa, thinks they are the England of Africa. And I was like, God fucking damn.
I always thought we were the USA more than anything.
But he's, you know, he's pretty honest. It was a Nigerian dude, and the colonial link was there, and it was too good. And that was like an Adam Gilchrist six, bro. It smashed that shit way out of the bounds. So I was like, oh, he's unruly. He's very right, though.
South Africa is a strange fucking country.
Yo, you know what? I've come to realize that we as South Africans have been putting up with a lot of shit for a long time. And I've always been like conscious of like, you know, there's always been corruption. There's always been like lack of service delivery. Service delivery can be wrapped with corruption, petty crime, which is due to a lack of service delivery. But I didn't really, and you know, last year we went through the fucking civil unrest in Durban, which was crazy. But you know, and people are going through craziness every year. But I never really contextualized my brain and like how much shit we go through until I got into a South African meme page the other day, and I was going through all the things that they talk about that's wrong with, they would like jokingly take it wrong, and I was like, fucking hell, we have like over 40 or 50 things wrong. But I'm guess it's probably better off than some other places, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's always my thing. It's like, well, the way I try to like just resolve stuff in my brain so that I don't go insane is just like, nothing was ever promised to you. I mean, like, you know, I'm a white dude, so like some stuff's assumed.
Yeah.
But you know, like, yeah, no, like nothing in this world was ever like going to be like anything other than it is, I guess, you know? And it's like, it's up to me to make decisions based on that. Or like everyone else, just like kind of stay in the boiling water and just chill like as a frog in a sauna. Yeah, it's like, jacuzzi frog is the best kind of frog.
Well, as we always, or like a millennial context, is that it's fine meme, you know, the dog in the fire.
Oh yeah, 100%. It's like, this is fine.
At one point though, I was like, when Iran and the US in early 2020 were like, they're going to get into a nuke thing, I was like, fuck yes, this is the time. I'm about to catch that permanent tan. Maybe this existential suffering will end. I've peaked in 2019. Like,
that is the problem with our generation, is because like, this isn't even like, you know, this is just a joke that's told on Twitter every day.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, cool, we're going to die now. Yay. And it's like, a part of me is like, I'm bored of that. And a part of me is also just like, I just want to go live on a farm, like, you know, with my computer, like definitely with the computer and the internet. Elon Musk, bring that Skylink, let's go. And then, you know, just chill as far the fuck away from everything as possible.
Yeah, man. But also a part of me, like, I would love to detach and like separate, and like everybody that I know that owns land and like that's theirs, I'm always just like, yo, you have made the right decision.
Exactly. Well, yeah. However, land is good. Like, property might be different.
However, I'm a city boy. Like, a city boy is up, yeah? Like, I'm out here. But
do you think you always will be?
I think a part of me would always need to be close to a city. And maybe I will return to my roots, like a town like Bluff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Just go down the South Coast. Toti, like,
the Bluff, you know, 15 minutes, 10 minutes away.
But the Bluff is not like, yeah, the Bluff's, you know, the Bluff. It's
technically not Durban, but it's Durban. It's technically Durban, but it's not Durban. You know what I mean? It's the, sure, it's a whole new world. And I think that for me is idyllic. You know, you're 15 minutes away. That ship would be even better if we had a real public transport system.
Yeah,
like you could just hop on a train and it took you 5 minutes to get from here to the Bluff, man.
Bro, like, yeah, this country would be a different country if we had good public transport. But
that's the crazy thing about the Zondo. It just blows my mind how much money has gone missing everywhere,
and also how much money got spent on the fucking Zondo commission. Like,
yeah, what I tinfoil hat for a moment. What's your speculation on the parliament thing?
Oh fuck, I don't even fucking know. I've got no theories on this shit. Like, I don't know anything. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm just like, Maybe, like, did someone set a fire? Okay, cool. Well, then find out who the fuck did it. Don't you have cameras? The dude that they put in the stocks, like, looked a little frazzled and didn't necessarily seem like the kind of guy that would do the thing, but I don't fucking know him, so, like...
Yeah, man, and from what I've been following, it's, like, it's hard to... Like, I don't have any opinions on this, but I do have the opinion that I don't know... This is not clear. This is not what you've been telling me.
That's 100% certain.
My spidey sense tingles.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's the... Like, my bullshit detector is, like, at its maximum. Like, the Geiger counter just, like, just maxing the fuck out. Yeah. It's just like...
It's really redlining.
Yeah, like, fully. Like, that's for sure. But, I mean, we had riots literally right outside my flat. Like, I was watching people put fucking, like, lounge suites and Buc-ee's across the road from me. And no one's in jail, are they?
Yeah, man. And also, you know, it's the wild thing is that, like, we as South Africans, we've never dealt with the trauma, yo. We've never fully unpacked the trauma.
What about the TLC commercial?
This is what it's one. It's like land. It's like so many of the things that we never really, like, the things that we continue to grapple with as a nation that continues to divide us.
Well, yeah, because there's just so much that's unfair about current society based on very recent history. Like, people are dealing with living through having to be removed from their homes, not having to be, but being removed from their homes, being taken to a shittier area. And now the government said, yeah, well, you can get your stuff back. Well, you can get your land back, but you're going to die before that happens.
Many people have died before that happened.
Exactly.
It's like, pretty wild. It's like, I could, like, we would need 3, 4, 5 podcasts to unpack.
Yeah, but we're not the guys to
unpack it. And we're not the people to unpack it, man. And it's a very complicated thing. But, like, we as South Africans, we go through a lot, man. And I don't think we actually ever, and I think it reflects really well in the art that is created. Because, like, as much as there's commercial surface level shit, there's a lot of really engaging shit, whether it be the visual arts, whether it be music, whether it be
I agree with you 100%.
Filmmaking, especially, I think, South Africa's getting there. We're at that point.
But then we can bring up the big issue of most South Africans don't get to see good South African films.
It's because y'all don't know how to pirate. But it's true.
I don't think the piracy is a good term for copying a file.
Yeah, it's just redistribution of the arts. But, like, for real, the reality of the situation is that, like, it's a very complicated situation, and the mechanisms of the and machinations as well of the film industry is very complicated, and how distribution works is very tough. And to just even to get a film out as an African to an audience is, like, the internet is the great equalizer.
Yeah.
But it's also, there's a counterbalance to this shit. Like, the streaming is a counterbalance. And we're not just seeing it in the physical in terms of that we're already a country that has an issue with cinemas and we don't have enough cinemas. We have a lot of mainstream cinemas that they themselves are struggling with.
Well, but it's also because they're overpriced. And they book terrible fucking movies.
Well, it's because we prioritize the dollar in these situations. Well, not the dollar, the money.
Yeah.
And what sells the most is, like, the thing about, like, when you commit to putting out independent shit, if you've ever been in a DIY background, you understand this. But, like, when you
you're just not going to reach the same audience.
It's not going to reach the same audience, and you're not going to make the money that you're doing it. But contributing, you can go to bed at night saying that you contributed to the art, and that's something that's whether you wanted to live with this. And I mean, it's made people in institutions extremely famous way later on in ways that they couldn't have imagined. I mean, I can't imagine, like, when all that beatnik poetry was happening in the cafes of New York, no one imagined that, like, people would be celebrating that stuff, what, 60 years later?
Yeah.
40, 50 70
years? Years later now.
70 years later? Like, yeah, Ginsberg has been dead how many years, yeah? And, so to go back to it, it's like, and what does make money? Big things with big marketing budgets that can go and they're digestible to people. Like,
but everyone, I also just hate the thing, though, that commercial has to be bad.
Commercial doesn't have to be bad.
But it does. Like, because in the minds of your Disneys and of your, like, big companies that are trying to get stuff in China and India and South Africa and Brazil and America and fucking, you know, wherever else, and they want the same film to play and they want everyone to dig it, they're never going to say anything.
Yeah, but that's not actually true. I think there are films that have been, well, I mean, you say that, but, like,
I mean, they say stuff, but it's very,
like, if you think about it, the first Matrix was not it's a commercial film. but sure. I mean, and it was seen around the world. It's
It's a breaking of the form for sure.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's the solidifying of like of Miramax and the Weinstein Company being like getting their formula down for like commercial success.
Sure. For okay, yeah.
But it was backed by Warner Brothers. You know what I mean? And Warner Brothers has been
in this hence why we got number four. It's if. Yeah, Warner Brothers.
I'm holding my. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm holding my things. I didn't end up watching it. I ended up watching something else.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts because I really loved it, but like, it's also an incredibly cynical and incredibly sincere film, and like, yeah. Like,
I would expect nothing less from the Wachowskis, to be honest with you.
It's just the one, but yeah.
Yeah, but anything the Wachowskis have done in their past, like. And I think it comes down
to it.
Yeah. I mean, even something as wild as Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas is an interesting allegory.
People hated Cloud. Well, some people hate Cloud Atlas.
People don't like long movies, yo. That was before, I think like that came out just after The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight might have been one of the longest commercial films since like, I'm going to guesstimate since Titanic.
Yeah, and that it just.
Oh no, since Avatar. Because Avatar must have been what? 3 hours long?
I haven't seen it, so I don't know. And like, that's just a film
I'm never going to... And hence why we're getting another one.
It's a film I'm just never going to fucking watch. Don't care. But I've seen Dancing with Wolves. It's fine. Don't hate Dancing with Wolves with blue people. That's what I've heard. It's Dancing with Wolves with Smurfs, from what I hear.
More in depth, if you want to get good, if you wanted to like give it some respect, it's The Last of the Mohicans, but in the digital form. Like that's a really like... So, but like, when we talk commercial, it doesn't have to be bad. Like, look at fucking Dune, yo.
Yeah,
Dune is a masterpiece of cinema. Yeah,
I mean, I haven't seen it yet, which is crazy to anyone listening to this thing. But my girlfriend and I just
need to see it
together, and like, well, just between like being in Joburg a lot, like at the time that it was like in the cinemas and stuff like that. You know, I wanted to see it in IMAX, but then yeah, just never got to it.
It's a really good piece, but I mean, also that dude had because also it's like if you think about it, right?
But it's also like it's a book.
Like Tarantino's films aren't commercial films now. They're independent cinema in their essence, but they're like...
They don't like draw the same kind of money as actual commercial films.
Yeah, they do. Though. Yeah, they do. Like, really? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was like... did massive numbers, yeah? And okay. it has the marketing. Commercial, also, you're talking about, is not just drawing the numbers. It's also... It has the funds and the machinations behind it to...
Like, sure, to get seen and heard.
Yeah, and like, everyone knows the Oscars is a marketing campaign.
Well, obviously.
Like, you can talk to anybody who's been a nominee for the Oscars, and they'll tell you, like, the only way you're going to succeed is money. And this was, like, the famous thing that the Weinsteins were famous
for. So, my octopus teacher had money.
Yeah, it's Netflix, doc. I mean... Ooh. Netflix did the same thing with Roma a couple of years ago. That was their first film. I don't know if you remember. It's a really great film by Alfonso Cuarón. He did Children of Men.
Oh yeah.
And he that was good. Yeah, he's an incredible like director. Mexican cinema is insane. Mexican cinema and South African cinema like have some interesting parallels that I would love to expound upon sometime. Like maybe in another like podcast or something. But
well, we can talk about that just now.
To be honest with you, and it was a film where they made it was an art house film and they had the rights to it, and they didn't want to show it at film festivals, but they had to because to qualify for the Oscars, you have to go meet certain criteria. It's not just money. You also have to show at certain festivals and places and
like Sundance, regions, etc. Yeah. And not just Sundance, but
like a bunch of them. There's a bunch Toronto, of like Diff in South Africa is an Oscar qualifying festival. My film
happened recently, hey, like in the last few years.
No, it's been around kind of a thing, but you've also had to do other measures. It's been around for a while. Maybe as long as I've been in the film industry, so like eight years, 9 years.
Okay.
But they kind of broke the fourth wall because no one had ever done with, well, not fourth wall. They broke the mold of it because it was a streaming platform and it only screened, I think it screened at maybe a handful of cinema screenings. And it's a beautiful like art house piece, but it's technically a commercial film because if you understand what commercial, if we interrogate what commercial means, just because commercial speaks to a lot of sensibilities.
See, so that's the thing in my mind, like,
because there's independent cinema.
I get like stuff on Netflix is still commercial. Like I get that. So, although at the same time, like sometimes when you see things, you can like kind of think, oh, this is indie. But like with this platform, with this potential audience, does that change things?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. I mean, it's also about it's budget as well. It's storytelling. Because also there are people who make commercial films that speak to like things, but they do it in an independent space and they're still independent for cinema. Like There's a bunch of that. Like A24 is a great example of that.
A24's commercial is fuck in terms of money. but in terms of style, it's...
There was also a weird period of time in like the 90s where like filmmakers like Spike Lee, filmmakers like John Singleton, filmmakers like... Catherine Bigelow.
Oh, yes.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, in his early days, he made films for cheap.
Yeah, but they were guys who the big studios and big platforms went to, like, hunted them down to make films, and they also developed a lot of films that never got made, like had indie sensibilities by them, and because the studios were like, you know, they were going through what the music industry is going through right now, where they were like, ha, this is the shit that people like really relate to. We're gonna just mass produce this stuff. So if we can't hire these guys, if our films aren't currently speaking this language, we're going to hire these guys to make our films speak this language. Hence why you end up getting stuff like people taking gambles on like the Wachowskis.
Yeah. Although I was just thinking now, like, it's interesting. Point Break, even like being like a pretty like commercial masculine film. That's also got like these subversive, like
Hurt Locker is another one.
Yeah. Fuck. Yeah.
Hurt Locker is incredible. She's an underrated filmmaker. I think she's also my favorite Get the Bag divorce story, because she was married to James Cameron of Titanic and Think fame.
Okay.
And was making better films than him. And because he did Alien, they were like, oh, he's a better filmmaker.
I mean, Alien's pretty good.
And she was overshadowed for many years. And when she got divorced, she got a shit ton of money. Get your bag. And went out and made even better films than when she was like working under him.
Yeah, well, financial security does allow you to reach your vision a lot easier.
Yeah, but I think also, like, maybe being who knows what type of character that guy is like. He may just be, like, a controlling asshole. Well, he must have been that great because she divorced him.
Says a guy who's been dumped, you know, a few times.
Yeah, you know, so I am in the glass house. I can throw stones. I can
say you recognize real.
Like, yeah, real recognize real. Shit recognize shit.
I guess we can then... we'll be bringing to the end of this, and this is in a weird way like kind of an intro for another project we're going to be doing.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, we're going to be doing the Anti-Film Film Club, which is going to be a podcast with Tani Mungwe, who's someone you've worked with for many, many years.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're going to be discussing stuff like Mexican film and African film.
The plan is to do African film, and I'm really excited. It's nice to like be able to expound one's opinions, because her and I have had many opinions, you and I have had many opinions, you and three of us together have had many opinions.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very, I don't know, I'm just going to have to do some reading on the podcast, because I think I'm going to get schooled pretty hard by you two, because you both know so much, because you've been in the back end of African film and South African film for so long.
Her especially.
Yeah. You both know so much and are aware of like... yeah, all these different films that have come out, and you watch all these films. I'm going to have to like watch so much stuff that I'm not even like aware of at the moment. So I'm actually just really looking forward to that, because, yeah, I know there are other people who do, you know, African film podcasts, but personally, I just think the two of you have so much wealth, like such a wealth of knowledge, that it's going to be, you know.
You're just making me laugh. I'm really honored by and flattered at what you're saying, and I'm really excited for it. But you're just making a thing, and maybe we could sign off with this at some point. But like, my granddad, you say wealth of knowledge. My granddad used to call me a well of useless information, just unnecessary, and I still believe it. I think it's also what led me into doing what I'm doing.
Like, well, I think anyone that's listened to this podcast for an hour knows that to be true. And on that note, we'll catch you again pretty soon, or probably not, actually.
Probably not. On a new space. But thanks for having me, Bob. It's been a complete honor.
Yeah, and when people want to hear from you again, they can do so on the Anti-Film Film Club. Yeah. And follow you on?
You can follow me on Instagram, mharperarts. But more importantly, sign up to all the film information pages that there are across the country. Support local film. Go to cinemas if you can. Make cool shit. Ride free, citizen.
You enjoyed that? Yeah, you enjoyed that. I know I did. I've listened to it a few times whilst doing it, whilst editing it, and then again just to make sure that we don't say anything that gets us cancelled. Or, as we call it these days, quality control. Hey, how you doing? You notice anything different? Shoutouts to Damien Root for doing the sound design. And shoutouts to everyone who has supported this podcast through Patreon, through the website, through buying merch and all the various different ways that has been supported. Because, yeah, I was able to call Damien up. He is the brother of Kaylin Roots, who is an ex-guest on this podcast, and someone who I think is a shredder. And I definitely wanted some shredding on the intro to this podcast. So shout out to Damien Root for the sound design. And I decided, yeah, change up the formats a little bit. I've listened to the criticisms of this podcast and I've realized I am not Marc Maron. And I might not be able to get everyone on board with the whole me telling them my problems at the beginning of the podcast, you know. I don't know if that format works. But I can tell them to you at the end, because I know if you're listening at the end, that you really give a fuck about this thing. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate you. And for the other people who just want the content, there you go. You got it. You got the information that you might need. So fuck off now and let the rest of us hang out. I'm actually going to keep this somewhat short, but it is good to be back. Christmas time was fucking crazy. Family vibes, you know, always just interesting. I'd say I came away with some new material for stand-up comedy. I don't know when I'm going to be doing more shows. That's on the list. It's something I'm going to be getting done soon-ish, maybe. I've got material. It's the whole actually getting on stage thing. Like, Durban doesn't have a lot of promoters, and I don't have as much time as I would like, maybe. Maybe I do. Maybe I'm just lying to myself and I'm lying to you. Anyway, let me know what you think of the new format. As I say, I'm going to keep it short today, but there might be some times where I do the whole long intro thing as an outro, you know? And we can see if this is a thing that works for you. If not, let me know. And we can go back to me boring the fuck out of, like, random strangers whenever they see that their friend is on the podcast. With that out the way, obviously, once again, gonna let you know, a podcast brought to you by you over at patreon.com/almostperfect. And we are sponsored by The Print Room Durban and King's House of Herbs. So if you need anything printed, go to The Print Room. And if you need anything herbally related, go to King's House of Herbs. They are on Florida Road, right next to the firehouse. Also, shout out to the firehouse. Rad place to get some pizza. Cool team there. That's a freebie. That's just, you know, me being nice. With that out the way, shout outs to the cast and crew over at the $10 tier, the titular titles tier over patreon.com/almostperfect. That is Neil Green, our key grip, Vishendra Naidu, our spiritual advisor, Riz Ventura, the director of purchasing, King Julian, Karan Slemon, the almost perfect hedge fund manager, Russell Grant, our Far East correspondent, Karan Chetty, the assistant to the regional manager, Kath Jenkin, the inevitable ruler of the universe, and Queen Swifty Rousseau, who is our chief sales officer of Subtle Heresies in the greater Overberg region, our executive producer, Stephen Olafir, and our anonymous benefactor. Shout outs to all of you, and shout outs to everyone that has listened this far. I love you, and I will catch you on the flip side.